Trunk or Treat, a free community event to provide a safe and fun way for children to have Halloween fun and get some candy too. Noon to 2 p.m. October 21st on Gateway's Kenosha campus.
This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, and welcome to Education Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, and my guest today is Jackie Arce. Jackie Arce is an Associate Professor of New Media and the Graduate Director of the Master's in Professional Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Her areas of specialization are television studies, digital media and culture, media industries, and feminist media studies. Welcome, Jackie.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm very excited to have this conversation with you. I try to set these interviews up so that I get to talk to people whose work I admire, I'm fascinated by, and I just want to, you know, have this conversation. So here we are. So, you know, you and I were talking about this editorial that came out over the summer. Ezra Klein interviewed Sean Illing, who wrote this book along with his colleague Zach Gershberg on the paradox of democracy. And it was about looking at democracy as a communicative culture, where the open and free nature of speech in a democracy is kind of inherently unstable. It's a wonderful thing. It generates many good things. It's the form we prefer, but it can also turn into things that we don't expect. It can be vulnerable to fascist tendencies, for example, and that's partly a product of our media technologies or exploitation of our media technologies. So I just wanted to front load that book and some of those issues as part of our conversation, because I think it's an interesting touchstone. Maybe I could ask you, since we did talk about this earlier, have you had any thoughts since we last spoke about this this argument that comes from Sean Illing?
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating argument. I think it's one that isn't new, and one thing that the authors do in the book and in the interview on the Ezra Klein podcast is they talk about different moments in history and how new communication technologies have shifted the culture quite dramatically. So they look at the invention of the printing press and how that led to the Enlightenment. And, you know, the invention of the telegraph and, you know, in our lifetimes or, you know, the listeners' lifetimes, we have more experience of that conversation around television and social media. And those have so drastically shifted our cultural norms. I don't think that the argument that it's changing, you know, democracy is particularly new because, you know, as they discussed, like the ability to broadcast via mass media in radio and through print, you know, in large part facilitated the rise of fascism in, you know, a so-called democratic environment. Mm-hmm. So I think that's not new, but I do think the ways that it's happening via social media in particular are worthy of investigation. So the particular affordances of social media platforms, in the interview, they talk a lot about Twitter and the attention economy and the ways that politicians in particular, but reporters as well, use that platform and use the technology to spread their messages and the new ability for ordinary people to also get involved in those conversations and to proliferate their views, you know, has led to, on, you know, in a really optimistic way, we can think of the democratization of speech and knowledge. We're able to share ideas, and, you know, we sort of have this idea of, you know, the marketplace of ideas, and let the best ideas sort of triumph. I think that's the best possible version of, you know, how digital media could be used. And it's absolutely not what's happening right now because of the way that social media platforms are organized. And so one of the things I wish that they would have talked more about in the book and in the interview is the economic structure of our social media platforms. They are designed to keep us engaged for as long as possible. You know, the sort of economic model of selling our eyeballs or selling viewer eyeballs. Like, advertisers want to know that people are on the platform so that they're looking at advertisements. And that's what leads to a higher ad rate and higher revenue for the social media platforms. And so because of that, you know, the way that the platforms are designed are to keep us engaged. And one of the ways that we stay engaged is through outrage and extreme emotions, fear, anger. Sometimes, you know, this is not to say that it's always a bad thing, but those are the tools that are being used as the platforms are being designed. And so because it has this ad supported model, and we live in a capitalist society, you know, outrage is winning. And I think we see that showing up in our politics. So
And also more generally, the internet and social media, and before that, television, tend to fragment our attention. Is that the right word? We want emotional stimulation. We want entertainment. We don't want too much information. We want to be able to skim along or channel surf or follow clickbait. And I'm not saying that that's basic human nature, but it does seem that media platforms tend to exploit our vulnerability to that impulse, just like our bodies are vulnerable to consuming too much sugar, fat, and salt. We crave those things. There must be something in our attention apparatus that sucks us into, for example, clickbait, without us even knowing that it's happening or particularly wanting it to happen, but it feels compulsive. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. You know, in the book and the discussion between Sean Illig and Ezra Klein, it seems that they're kind of dismissive of entertainment. And, you know, like, there's something that we're going to call trash TV, or, you know, being on social media, or you just hear all these derogatory comments about, you know, TikTok and YouTube, and just sort of wasting your time away, or, you know, the image of the couch potato. It's just, you know, TV is rotting your brain. I don't come to it with that lens. I think entertainment is great. Like, I don't see it as necessarily bad, but I think that you're absolutely right that our desires to be entertained become exploited. And I think, to me, the root of it is this ad-based model, where the longer we stay tuned in, the more money media companies make. And so, you know, everything is sort of like being gamified, like, and there's all these new tactics to, like, keep us engaged for longer. So I do think there's a level of exploitation involved. I also think it's pretty important to differentiate between television and social media, because television as a mass medium, you know, is a one-to-many form of communication. And, mm-hmm. you know, so we get more mass messages or messages for a broad audience. That's mm-hmm. shifted. You know, we can't even talk about television as a singular medium, like broadcast television versus mm-hmm. cable television versus now, you know, streaming services. It is more niche. Mm-hmm. We get more content that's tailored to us, but it's on a very different level of what happens on social media platforms, where everything is exactly tailored to us based on our past clicks, how long we hover over videos, all of the data, everything we do online is being monitored in order to be monetized.
So do you recommend that we go to our privacy settings, or when they give you those options about, you know, I forget what that little pop-up says as the title, but, you know, you can look at how they use your data, and there's, you know, five items usually. Necessary cookies only, and then, you know, 100 other things. Do you bother to go through those, and do you recommend that we do and minimize the tracking, or does it not matter?
Yeah, both. So I do it. I recommend doing it. And also the amount it matters is minimal. I think we're going to see some shifts, especially because, you know, the internet exists on this global scale. And in particular in Europe, there's legislation that's around internet privacy. And so, you know, companies like Facebook are going to have to come up with some new ways to protect our privacy. And we're seeing more and more options available to, you know, now every website you go to, you have different options about the cookies and how they track you. So we are going to see some of that, but most of the ways that we're tracked, we, you know, are proprietary to those companies. We don't know about it, and they're not going to give us the option to opt out. So,
okay.
You know, we get these filter bubbles. Mm-hmm. It's Eli Prieser's term for, you know, the information silos that we get put into. And I think when it comes to the idea of democracy, or, you know, going back to this concept of, you know, a marketplace of ideas, we are not being exposed to the marketplace of ideas. We're being exposed to, in particular, ideas that we agree with and things that are going to cause outrage. So things that we may not agree with. And so, you know, we're getting further and further apart from one another. You know, we're seeing that in terms of political polarization, but in other realms as well. And I think that that's a really big cause of, you know, the direction that we're going and the challenges that we're facing to democracy. So I don't think it's just about an open communicative culture, because, you know, everybody's open to say whatever they want on social media platforms. But if it's, if we're not open to the messages that we can engage with, or the algorithms are putting us in these filter bubbles, you know, we're going to have a hard time even having dialogue.
Right. So what do you teach your students when you talk about media literacy? Do you connect it to citizenship or politics at all?
Absolutely. So, you know, each of the classes that I teach at the undergraduate level kind of focus in different areas in media studies. And the one that I'm teaching right now, and that seems kind of most pertinent to this conversation, is a class on media industries. And I, you know, I keep returning to this idea of, like, we have to understand how the business of media works and how these platforms are designed. Because without a broad understanding of the economic motivations that shape the content that we see, it's really easy to just take the content at face value. You know, going back to this interview with Sean Illing, they're talking lot about Marshall McLuhan's theory of the medium is the message, and how important it is to look at the actual form of media that a message is conveyed on, not just the message itself. And I would just add an extra step onto that, that we have to look at, you know, the business of that media to understand not just the technological affordances that it's using to convey messages, but what the motivations are behind creating those messages. And I think that additional context, and that's what we really focus on in my media industries class, just I just see in my students these light bulbs going off. You know, we're not just looking at the media text itself. We're not just looking at the message. We have an understanding of how it's created.
So if I'm, you know, today I looked at the New York Times, I looked at Facebook, I looked at a few other things. I looked at Amazon.com, where I sometimes go in lieu of going to a library, because you can look up a book there and get, you know, the dirt on it pretty quickly, which is convenient. But what would you tell me that I might not be seeing as I look at the New York Times and Facebook, just maybe to take those, or even Amazon? What's being filtered, or what's being constructed outside of my awareness that's influencing me in some way?
Yeah, so with Facebook, you know, as I mentioned, anything that you like, click on, any stories that you read, that is all shaping a digital profile that Facebook is putting together for you. So they not only know your demographic information, but they know your interests, they predict your interests, all to really predict your potential buying habits. But like I said, that creates these filter bubbles where the types of, you know, if you see New York Times stories in your Facebook feed, Facebook not only tracks what you do on their platform, but they embed cookies, and they track you all over the internet. This is not something exclusive to Facebook. Every website you go to essentially does this. That is why you will, you know, be shopping for a pair of shoes on Amazon one day, and then you'll see ads for it on every single site you go to.
Yes.
That's because every site you go to is tracking your online behavior.
Okay.
And using it to develop a profile of you. Facebook is just the best at, currently the best at monetizing that, because they have a platform that people spend a lot of time on, because it's become, you know, a social space where people connect with one another, but it's also become the primary place where folks get their news, whether it's through legitimate news sources or through links to sources that are not legitimate, that are blogs or you know, sites that look like news. So that is one way. I would also say, you know, the New York Times does it as well. So if you have an account with the New York Times, they're tailoring their front page to the things that you're interested in.
Really? So the front page does not look the same for every reader of the New York Times?
Right. And we've done this exercise in class, which is interesting. You know, we'll all pull it up. The headline story is going to be the same, but what's on your sidebars, what's below it, that will shift.
Wow.
Because all of our content is increasingly being tailored for us.
So this is a far cry from the days of ABC, CBS, and NBC, the three major news networks, where part of the argument that I think Sean Elling makes, and as you said, this is, argument has been made before, is that there was a kind of more of a cultural consensus, or it appeared that there was more of a cultural consensus, because we were all getting our news from the same three major news networks, and they weren't contradicting each other. Now, there can be something bad about that too, right?
Yes. And I think, you know, that's one of the lenses that I try to bring to each of my classes, is that whenever we're looking at any media phenomenon, there's going to be a utopian and a dystopian way to see it. You know, when there's only three news, you know, outlets or three news programs coming on nightly, in the network era, there was more consensus for sure. There also were tons of critically important stories that were not being told because they didn't fit into the model, or the interests of the people that were producing those news mm-hmm. programs. And so there was a lot that was missed.
Mm-hmm.
Now we live in an era where lots and lots of stories can get out because, you know, journalists are not as bound to editorial norms. And on, so, I mean, on social media, they can, you know, go somewhere and post what's happening minute by minute. We have immediate access, and citizen journalists or just citizens in general can go and let us know what's going on.
Mm.
I mean, we saw that in Kenosha.
You're talking about the Jacob Blake incident and the fallout after that, the marches,
right, you know,
and the rioting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, it was a national news story, and people that we knew were there, you know, and involved and posting.
Corey Elijah on his skateboard.
Yeah.
I want to just take a moment and remind our listeners that they're listening to Education Matters. I'm your host, Jonathan Shaler, and we're talking to Jackie Arce, professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. She's a media specialist, and she's engaging us in a fascinating discussion of the affordances and constraints of technological diversity of our media environment, I guess we might say. So, Jackie, when you... what are you learning from your students these days? We often talk about teaching and we often privilege the voice of the professor, but I'm very excited to learn from my students, and I know you are too. So what's coming up in your classes? What are you learning from your students?
Yeah, I like I said, I'm teaching this media industries class right now, and one of the coolest things is that they keep me up to date. I try to read as much as possible, and they just really keep me up to date. One of the things that they do at the end of the semester is a research project, and I have students writing about topics such as racism in the algorithms for the Spotify music platform, which... in my digital media class, we read Sophia Noble's Algorithms of Oppression, and that's all about how search engines, you know, that were created by human beings, you know, are, you know, have racism embedded in their the structure of them. But I wasn't aware of how this manifested on music recommendations that Spotify makes.
Wow.
So she's doing this great project about, you know, the racial backgrounds of artists and the recommendation algorithm and how it is increasingly segregated. And there's some really interesting research in that area. I have students writing about Facebook's Meta platform, which I've been reading about, but I've never been on myself. So that's one area. Another example from that class that has been pretty eye-opening for me is, you know, we talk a lot about media mandates. And, you know, what we've been talking about in this conversation is capitalist mandates and this, you know, ad supported platforms and how that just structures our media. And so we're used to just one way of thinking that television is, or one way that social media is, but there's nothing that predetermines that. The technology could be organized in fully different ways. And so I asked students to think about alternatives to that. What other ways could we organize the technologies that we have available to us? And they just come up with creative, amazing things. But one that sticks out to me is we were talking about sports media and like ESPN, which is something that I don't know a ton about. So I was really deferring to their knowledge. And, you know, it's the main sort of sports that you're seeing, you know, football, basketball, men's, you know, professional and college level sports. And so we talked about if there wasn't a commercial mandate and instead there was a public mandate to serve a community, how would we define that community? And then what types of sports would we see? Like women's sports maybe would be broadcast. Like, would we see like our local communities? Would we see more global sports? I mean, we see also just pretty much US-based stuff on ESPN. You have to get all these specialized channels to see different types of content. And so, you know, they were coming up with what a more kind of well-rounded set of sports programming would be if we didn't have a commercial mandate. And I just thought that was a really interesting thought experiment. And applies a lot to our conversation because we think of, okay, social media is just already this. Christian Fuchs has a book that's coming out later this month where he's thinking about what a public mandated social media platform would look like a YouTube or, you know, a Facebook that didn't have a profit motive, but was meant to serve the public. I haven't read it. Has it come out yet? I'm fascinated to see, you know, and I think I will probably start our next conversation in my media industries class of like, what would that be? What could it be? And right. I think that's important because we take it as, you know, this is how things are.
Yes. It does seem like part of what's implicit in everything you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a greater media literacy, which is largely what you're teaching in your courses, kind of in the absence of a more publicly mandated media ecology, we each become the curators of our own, not only media consumption, but media creation. And I want to touch back on that because we're so that the media consumption metaphor dominates, but what about media creation and the fact that we're also participants? but as on the media consumer side, just to simplify it for a moment, what if we are curators of our own media consumption in a way we're correcting for some of the problems inherent in the media environment that's been created through capitalist motives. Would you agree with that or would you say something different?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, to me, that is where things can be traced back to. I don't think that's the sole issue. And I think it's also very reductive to say like, oh, capitalism's the problem. You know, we're missing a lot when we do that. And and I think a lot of that is looking at the specificity of each platform, of how people use it, of the agency of creators and participants and, you know, those on the receiving end. Like, we do have agency. We can make any type of media we want. We can choose to engage with media in any way we want. So, but I think that the general shape of our available media platforms does severely limit those possibilities. And I think that can be kind of traced back to this profit motive.
Has NPR gotten sucked into the market economy to a greater degree in recent years?
You know, I don't know. I think NPR, you know, we we talk about this a lot in my classes as well, NPR and PBS, as, you know, the only two examples we have of a public mandate in media.
Mm-hmm.
I think their news coverage is the best out of any outlets we have, because, you know, it doesn't have an ad supported model, but it does have, you know, it has to raise a ton of money and to sort of jockey for lots of different ways to do that. And I think that's mm-hmm. a challenge in itself.
Mm-hmm. You know, do they count their viewers and do those numbers matter in some algorithm?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they track their ratings as well. That is important.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, they don't exist outside of the norms that we have in commercial media. I mean, even just the format of, you know, how long a program is, who gets interviewed, what types of stories are covered. I thought it was interesting in the conversation between Ezra Klein and Sean Illing, and they're talking about, you know, they wish there was an alternative news platform. You know, they're talking about the coverage of Trump and how everybody is just chasing every outrageous thing that he says, and we're kind of stuck in this cycle of that's dominated by Trump. Mm-hmm. And we're right back there now with his, you know, announcement that he's running for president
mm-hmm.
again. And, you know, but they couldn't imagine how it could be created, because how could a platform that didn't cover everything that Trump did? They were saying, you know, what if they only covered things that were surprising for Trump, like actually coming up with a policy?
Right.
And I thought that was really funny. But that platform couldn't compete. Because of the media environment, the news media environment that exists. I mean, that was their hypothesis. And I don't know whether that's true or not. I think there's a lot of people that would be interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
But does it translate to, you know, a reliable funding model? And I think that NPR sort of exists in that realm as well, where they, you know, they sort of try to cover things differently, but also have to compete with what everyone else is covering.
Yes.
And so I don't think it's, the mandates are a really important part of understanding media, but they're not the only one. It's not the only facet. I mean, all the way up to individuals, you know, individual reporters, editors, content creators mm-hmm. that make decisions, that shapes what we engage with as well.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of issues are you grappling with in your research?
That is, you know, something that I have been thinking a lot about, and I've been working with another media studies scholar, Allison Page, who teaches at Old Dominion University. And we've been sort of grappling with the depressing side of thinking about social media. One of the theories that we both really tend to agree with comes from a theorist, Jody Dean, and she has this theory of communicative capitalism. And it has to do with, you know, the constant stream of information on social media being the essential function of it itself. You get sucked up into this stream of information. You have effective responses to it. You want to stay engaged. And it doesn't matter what types of content is being posted. It all can be monetized. It's all free labor that the people who are posting are contributing. It's being monetized by social media companies, and it keeps us engaged. And that, to me, I think it is a really powerful metaphor for how social media functions. And it is also the most depressing thing that I can think, because as somebody who's also really invested in activism and ways of shifting our society and culture, Social media activism seems and has seemed to me to be very promising. You know, there are new ways for us to connect, to build coalitions, to raise awareness around particular issues. And under Jody Dean's model, it doesn't matter. It's all getting, you know, sucked up into communicative capitalism. That's probably, I don't know that Dean would say that. That might be a reductive summary. But so what Allison and I have been thinking about are, like, what possibilities might there be? And we wrote an article a couple years ago about the Me Too movement and about the emotions that people were expressing and the effective connections that people were making on the platform. And so, yes, in many ways, the Me Too movement has sort of been very helpful for social media platforms in terms of creating lots of interest and lots of activity. And it has also gotten kind of wrapped up into ideas of popular feminism and women's empowerment. And we're sort of now seeing a backlash to the Me Too movement where, you know, survivors of sexual abuse in the workplace are not being believed. And, you know, you could, the recent case with, you know, Johnny Depp, and Amber Heard, all the harassment that she faced and him, you know, winning that case, you know, there was just a lot of, I think we're in this backlash moment. And I think, you know, so there's a way to see the Me Too movement as really not being as successful as we might have hoped and, kind of falling into, that sort of depressing realm. But what Allison and I are trying to think about is, you know, can emotions in particular and bodily reactions and sort of the affective feelings that get evoked through social media interactions, those can't be, emotions can't be captured by capital, you know? those people created real bonds and real ties. And so I think that there are some possibilities there. And we're working on a new piece now that's looking at the Chilean dance protests that I believe started in 2019. The performance is called Un Violador en Tu Camino, A Rapist in Your Path. And it's calling out sexual violence and also naming it as state violence. And so we're looking at that performance, but also how it got circulated on YouTube. And it's fascinating because the comments on YouTube, people are talking about how emotionally impactful it was for them, how they were crying when they watched it, how they got goosebumps. And so, yes, it helps YouTube's, you know, bottom line. But also it connected people and so trying to see, you know, as I said, those lenses of really utopian or dystopian, how do you balance that? And so I try to look for the light when I'm feeling like things are quite dark.
Yeah. Wow. That's a fascinating vein of research. And I'll be interested to hear how that article that you just mentioned develops and also where you and Allison take things next. It sounds like this might be an ongoing partnership.
Yeah, you know, it's, I think I really enjoy collaboration. And also, you know, when I sort of get stuck in a way of seeing the world, talking to somebody else and generating ideas is so fruitful and I love that about academia.
Fantastic. Yeah. I've got to write my next article with a co-author.
It's also, it can be a challenge, you know, I've met with people who don't like it. So, you know,
I can see where there'd be a push pull.
Thinking style.
Yeah, it sounds like a good challenge, and there's something about the relationality of it. and the way it pushes your own thinking, where you can kind of come together with someone to a new terrain of understanding that maybe wasn't there for either of you before you began. So I think that's exciting. Okay, so we have about 2-3 minutes left. And what is it that you would like to talk about in that time? I'm giving you the floor.
I think I'll kind of come back to, you know, the article that we started with that we've been discussing throughout, or the podcast episode, because I think I would like to give a little bit of a disclaimer for listeners. I think Ezra Klein is a wonderful journalist, and Sean Illing is a really, you know, has a great political mind. He comes from a political theory background. But my plug would be for reading media studies material.
Give us recommendations, please.
Okay. because they cite extensively Marshall McLuhan, whose book came out in the 60s, I believe, and Neil Postman, whose book came out in the 80s.
Okay, so Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death, and Marshall McLuhan, The Medium is the Message?
Right.
Okay.
So those are really interesting books. The field of media studies has just exploded since the 70s and 80s. So I would recommend really on any topic, but as I said, Sophia Noble's book, Algorithms of Oppression, if you're interested in how algorithms work and their social effects, it's a fascinating book. Mm-hmm.
And what's that one Fuchs, that's coming up from Fuchs?
It's called Digital Democracy and the Digital Public Sphere. And it's a part of a whole series that he has done about digital media and democracy. I think this is book 6 in that series. I mean, he is very prolific.
Okay.
those are good places to start. Amanda Lotz has wonderful work in television studies that tracks, you know, very specific elements of, you know, the advertising models, the distribution patterns, production cultures. And she, you know, if you think TV is one thing, read her, because she will explode that idea and provide all of the industrial background.
How do you spell her last name?
L-O-T-Z.
Say again?
It's L-O-T-Z.
Oh, good. Glad I asked, because I would not have guessed that. Okay. any others? We have about a minute.
I think that's a good place to start. You know, I just think media studies scholarship does a really good job for the most part of walking that line between, you know, technological determinism, which that's where I would classify McLuhan and Postman of, you know, technology is defining us. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, we have cultural determinism. That's, you know, people really have the power. It's not technology. And to me, the truth is somewhere in between. Mm. Like, the technology is not determining our society. It's not going to be the make or break for democracy. And it's not just people either. It's both together. And so scholarship that accounts for that, accounts for power, accounts for historical context, economic context, social context. I think that is the best way that we can understand our current moment.
Well, thank you so much, Jackie Arce, Associate Professor of New Media and the Graduate Director of the Masters in Professional Communication at UW Parkside. It's been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you spending some time for us today. This is Education Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, and we'll see you again soon.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
I'm Gregory Berg, and coming up on Monday's morning show here on WGTD, a thorough and exciting preview of the next concert of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. It's going to be a spectacular night of music, which will feature the Violin Concerto of Peter Tchaikovsky, the Third Symphony, the Eroica of Ludwig van Beethoven, and the Overture to Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. We'll be talking to the board president, the conductor, and soloist on Monday's morning show beginning just after 8.
Well, this week on WGTD's Noon Tunes, we're enjoying the music of acclaimed Kenosha Christian singer-songwriter Anna Nuzzo. At the end of every